The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Marshall Matters with me, Winston Marshall, for The Spectator. Today I have the pleasure of being joined by Nick Gillespie, who is the editor-at-large at the libertarian magazine and website Reason.com, and he's the author of the book The Declaration of Independence and a friend. Thank you so much for coming to speak.
It's extremely great to be on here. Can I suggest that you change the name, though, of the podcast to The Marshall Plan? Then start becoming more prescriptive and demanding how the world should change.
If I was American, that would be the name.
Yeah.
Well, I was wondering if we could start. There's a few things I want to discuss. I want to ask about libertarianism and American libertarianism, censorship in America, free speech in America. But I wanted to start, if I may, with something that I find that I haven't fully understood, which is the book banning. Obama last week on his Twitter put out, and on his website put out a piece decrying the book banning, not just of LGBTQ literature. He even mentions conservative literature, and it's the case that books like Genderqueer, a graphic novel by Maya Kobe, Flamer, a graphic novel by Mike Garatto, and This Book Is Gay by Juno Dawson, these books are, sort of seem to be progressive literature that is being banned. At the same time, conservative literature, if it can be called conservative literature, like, for example, Abigail Schreier's Irreversible Damage about the phenomenon of gender dysphoria amongst young teenage girls, that's also being banned. I wondered if you could explain what exactly is happening.
Yeah, there has definitely been increased attention paid to what is in public libraries and particularly school libraries, K through 12 school libraries, mostly public school libraries over the past couple of years. I mean, this is a definite battleground in the culture wars, which increasingly are dictating all the conversation in American politics. Like, you know, I've been at Reason was established in 1968. I've been there since 1993, so coming up on 30 years actually being there. And until maybe a decade ago, we used to talk a lot more in politics about things like the size of the national debt, whether or not we should be running an annual deficit, what is good versus bad foreign policy. And, you know, realistically, over the past 5 to 10 years, more and more topics have been gravitating to this culture war type stuff. So that's, you know, should gay people have the same rights to get married as straight people, et cetera? That was one thing, you know, that got solved. Now we're talking about trans issues and things like that. And then it plays out increasingly in what books do you allow in a public space, right? How do colleges, what kinds of students do they admit or not, private or public, but especially, you know, when we're talking about public policy, it's really about public schools. And, you know, this the book banning stuff, you know, it's wrong to call these book bans in the sense that they are not, it's not censorship, it's not George Orwell, it's not Ray Bradbury and Fahrenheit 451, where people are going around and, you know, burning books or extirpating them. Interestingly, there are increasing attempts to stop certain books from being published. That overwhelmingly seems to be coming from the left. So when there are books that, you know, are deemed to be politically incorrect or not sufficiently woke, or, you know, they transgress some line, you will see online campaigns to get publishers to drop certain books.
What would be an example?
There was a book that came out a while ago, a couple of years ago, called American Dirt. And it was a book written by a white American about a Hispanic woman kind of moving, illegally migrating to the United States. And that became a huge flashpoint. The book was published. It was a massive publishing success. So it didn't work. And that's also important to think about. But, you know, in the broader context of cancel culture, there are, you know, more and more visible attempts to shut down certain types of speech. You know, what's interesting is that I think in a profound way, this reflects the fact that more people are able to speak more freely in more places than ever before. So, you know, the one way of thinking about it is like we are in this repressive cycle where people are trying to shut down speech they disagree with. I think that's true. But paradoxically, and probably more important, there are more ways to speak than ever before.
That ties in with Martin Gurry's theory of there being so much, we're in an age of so much information.
Yeah. It's, and these venues, whether, you know, he talks in The Revolt of the Public, which I think is, you know, one of the essential guides to the past 15 or 20 years and probably the next 15 or 20 years. He talks a lot about how Twitter, you know, underwrote or empowered the Arab Spring. In a way that was unpredictable or unforeseeable. It's kind of ironic now that Twitter during COVID and during these types of kind of battles, Twitter is a site of censorship, right? Or of repressing certain types of speech. But in the end, we live in an age where more people can talk in more ways than ever before. So I think we should be careful in just denouncing the idea that we live in an age of censorship, because that's true. I mean, people are trying to control speech more than ever, but more speech escapes that. That's kind of a broad, almost anodyne backdrop to what you're talking about, though, with, you know, public library bans and school bans. And, you know, there's no question that kind of K through 12 education curricula have always been political. They're getting more and more increasingly politicized. And now people are arguing, and often in terms that I think are wrong, to say, you know, like, is it wrong to take a book like Gender Queer, which is very sexually explicit, like independent of what kind of sex is going on, it's very sexually explicit. And it seems to me we have to be having a series of different conversations. And instead of saying, you know, genderqueer is challenged and it's in the adult section or the young adult section of a public library. That's one thing to say. It's being removed from a middle school library. You know, that kind of makes sense because it really is sexually explicit in a way I don't think most people would say, yeah, that's good for fifth graders or third graders. And then there's that broader context of, like, the fact is more and more books from LGBTQ plus authors are being published and are being read, which, as a libertarian, I like free speech. I like individualism. I like people being able to express themselves. But then we're having these struggles over, you know, in what context, et cetera. And we're kind of having the wrong debate in a lot of ways.
What do you think the correct debate is?
I think the correct debate is to be thinking about, with something like K through 12 education, if the school curriculum and if the school library is stocking books or the teachers are pushing books and curricula, you know, a curriculum on your kids that you don't believe in, you know, the policy fix to that isn't to say, okay, everybody who lives in this school district either gets something taught, you know, to them, whether the parents like it or not, or they are not allowed to learn about this. It's to create more school choice so that there are more ways that parents can match their kids to the schools that they want. And that's also a big movement right now for public school choice as well as, you know, private school choice.
That's still pretty complicated, moving your kid because—
A little bit, yeah.
But do you think sort of it's almost like a federalist system?
Yeah, totally. I mean, like, you know, and I say this as somebody, I grew up lower middle class where, you know, we're talking in New York. I grew up about 50 miles from here in New Jersey. And I went to very academically shitty Catholic schools that my parents paid for. And that was a version of school choice. The public schools were much better academically, et cetera. But they, you know, they said they wanted, you know, whatever a Catholic education meant to them, which generally I interpret as meaning like academically less serious than the public school, strangely. But, you know, if my parents didn't like what the Catholic school was teaching, they could go to the school and say, hey, we don't like this. Would you do something about it? And then if the Catholic school said, fuck you, then they would go to the public school or another school. And, You know, I think that's a better fit. You know, we have something like over 100,000 school districts in America right now. We should have maybe 30 million or however many K through 12 students there are, because everybody should be able to find an education that, you know, or every parent should be able to find an education that they think is good for their kid.
But you mentioned Twitter and actually, we're being in an age of abundance of free speech, but you and I were both in Memphis a week or so ago, listening to RFK Jr., who was part of his presidential campaign. He was censored through COVID. He claims to be the first man to be censored by the Biden administration. There seems to be, even though it might be an abundance of free speech owing to social media, there's also a lot of censorship going on.
And again, censor, you know, I don't want to be pedantic about it, but censorship, or squelching of speech. I mean, like, you know, censorship, I really think of, I think it's best to keep that as sharply defined as possible. And that is when a government or, a government that has the force of, you know, police says this speech is not allowed and we're going to go out and strike it down. I'm on the board of a group called Ideas Beyond Borders, which translates Western works or various works about pluralism and free speech and a lot of values like that, a lot of Enlightenment values into Arabic, and then, you know, distributes them for free as ebooks in the Arab speaking world. And, you know, there are countries where if you are caught in possession of a book, you are killed or you're put in prison. We're not there. And, you know, that kind of censorship, I don't want to diminish that plight with, you know, the fact that RFK Jr., who I disagree with a lot. I absolutely agree that his speech was squelched on Twitter and on Facebook and other social media accounts. He was bounced, you know, in ways that I find incredibly egregious. Mm-hmm. So to, you know, get to the point, it's this is another paradox, right, which is that Twitter facilitates more speech and more people being able to say whatever they want. And it also definitely was revealed in the Twitter files reasons Robbie Suave did he got information about Facebook that was very similar, where there is no question that Facebook, Twitter, other social media platforms, certainly YouTube, they were not just pressured by the government to shut down certain accounts or to squelch the reach of certain information because it ran afoul of some government, you know, some government apparatchiks, but that people at these platforms were going to the government and saying, hey, what do you think about this? Like, should we squelch this? So there's something really rotten and sickening in all of that. And it's good to expose that. And it's good to hold companies accountable.
I'm interested about the legal side of it, because that's Section 230,
right,
which gives them free from the liability of should a user take
slander or libel someone.
It's not their responsibility, and that would be insane because it would be, they would have to be vet every single.
There would be no. I mean, the internet as we know it would be very, very different. There would be no user generated content, which is really what has made the internet what it is. By the same token, that Section 230 also gives platforms the right to limit speech or to kick people off, and to moderate some speech without having to moderate all speech, et cetera, and things like that.
Well, there's an argument about whether Twitter is the public square.
Right.
And so I think technically it has to be the government that's stopping free speech, and it would be the case in Twitter files that it was the government colluding to stop free speech. But let's say the government weren't involved in that, and it was just the social media. In fact, in the speech that RFK gave, that we both watched at Elvis Presley's car park garage, amongst his Bentleys and Rolls and all these
doom buggies.
RFK gave the example of the 1972 case where a Vietnam anti-war protester in a shopping mall, they were throttled by the mall, and then they went to the Supreme Court. Now, RFK claimed in the speech we saw that the Supreme Court sided with the protesters and that the mall was a public space. Well, actually, RFK is wrong. I looked that up.
Yeah.
In fact, the Supreme Court sided with the mall and that it was private land. Yeah. And so it wasn't a public space. Where do you think the law should be on this? Is Twitter the public square?
No. Or rather, it should not be a it should not be a square that is regulated in the public interest, like the way that broadcast networks are, broadcast radio still is, because I think when you cross that line and you say, okay, you know what, we're effectively going to nationalize this and say it's so important and so ubiquitous that we are going to limit how you can control what speech is allowed or disallowed on your platform. Ron DeSantis in Florida and Greg Abbott in Texas, the two governors in Republican states with Republican majorities in the legislature, have passed laws doing this to social media companies of a certain sort, saying you can't disallow this speech, you can't do this, because they believe that conservative voices are being systematically squelched, and those are being held up in court because they, however bad Twitter was, you know, before Elon Musk, and now I guess it's X, you know, is after Elon Musk, it's going to be much, much worse if the government is saying this speech is allowable and this speech is not. That would be a blow to free speech. The other thing that we should think about is I have a, you know, and this is, I'm a libertarian, so I believe in, you know, that markets are not perfect, but they facilitate a lot of options. And we have seen just in the past couple of years, a raft of alternatives to something like Twitter, right? You know, we have Threads most recently that is, you know, from Meta.
Which has completely flopped.
It hasn't completely flopped. It had a big, you know, rush, and now people are less interested in it, mm-hmm. right? But you also have Noster and Blue Sky and a variety of other programs and platforms. And it seems to me, you know, Twitter has also changed because they have to respond to criticism, and that it's better to work through kind of market forces and say, you know, to protest, to, you know, go to the people who run these platforms and say, you know what, this isn't working, push for change within that or create your own. And now, having said that, you know, back in the day, not very long ago, you know, conservatives did, that was a stock liberal answer when, you know, conservatives would say, hey, we're getting screwed on Facebook and Twitter. And liberals would say, well, go build your own platform then if you don't like it. And, you know, then conservatives did that with Parler in particular. Right. And then, you know, various other, you know, liberal or progressive people working at Amazon Web Services and in other, you know, and in app stores kept trying to keep Parler down. So it's not clean, it's not easy, but I think that kind of rough and tumble is far preferable to giving the government, you know, the very government that nobody trusts, the ability to say this speech is okay, you cannot censor this speech, you have to carry this speech. No thanks. We did that throughout all of the 20th century in mass media, you know, whether it was radio, TV, whatever, and it was a disaster.
What do you mean we did that?
We, you know, the government said in order to, if you were a TV station that broadcast over the air or a radio station, you had to carry certain speech, or you couldn't not carry things. You had to have things like the Fairness Doctrine. You had to have equal time. And what that did was it degraded public discourse so that only a few viewpoints would be aired.
Uh-huh.
What we live in now, and this, I think, for me, is one of the conceptual kind of frameworks or the conceptual breakthroughs we need. And I have been struggling to articulate this, so maybe it's just like an inchoate and dumb thought in my mind. But it seems to me we're in a world now where so many things are possible and so many things are happening and so many great things are happening, particularly in terms of mass personalization, individual empowerment, autonomy. But we're struggling to kind of understand them and regulate them through a 20th century model of kind of top down, you know, top men, you know, the best and the brightest controlling things from the top. Everything in the 21st century is the best parts are about bottom up, emergent orders, individuals doing what they want. And we need to come up with kind of mindsets as well as institutions and political policy solutions that take that into account and allow that to kind of proliferate rather than say, no, you know, what we need to do is to maintain a monopoly, you know, a political duopoly between Republicans and Democrats and speech rights between liberals and progressives and conservatives. Like we look around in the world and it is, you know, for the first time in human history, according to the Brookings Institution and some UN charters, a majority of people around the world live in middle-class circumstances. Mm. This is unbelievable. We never talk about that. We don't talk about the implications of that. We live in a world where you can self-publish anything you want, and you have a chance of getting an audience for it. Mm-hmm. And we are talking about, you know, we've got to keep Genderqueer or To Kill a Mockingbird or Huck Finn mm-hmm. out of eighth grade English. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, what the fuck? We are, we're like Dr. Faustus in Christopher Marlowe's Faustus, where it's like, suddenly, you know, we have the ability to do anything we want. We have this incredible demonic power in the best way possible. And we're doing things like pinching girls' asses and laying sausages on the nose of the Pope. We're locked in a struggle, a twilight struggle for the 20th century, which we've left behind. Uh-huh. We should be doing better with all that is available to us.
Something's happening both my country and your country. And if I can just go back one step to the social media issue, is in my country it's coming through the online safety bill.
Yep.
And here, 200 school districts have joined to litigation against big tech companies to childproof the internet. Yep. This seems to be one of the fault lines on free speech. What's the significance of this?
How much am I allowed to curse on this podcast?
Curse away.
I don't know. School districts will do everything to blame everybody except themselves. Like the idea that the reason why school kids aren't learning is because of TikTok or Instagram or Facebook is so fucking embarrassing. I mean, you know, in New York State, the average K through 12 cost per pupil is something like $30,000, mm-hmm. and they can't teach kids to read.
Mm-hmm.
That isn't because of social media. It's something that is happening in the schools. And again, I think better school choice, you would be matching kids with schools that they're actually interested or that know how to teach to that particular kid, et cetera. I think, you know, I think you would see a lot of these social problems disappear. Because they're not really problems. It's just like, you know, if you were an intellectual kid and you got sent to a football school, mm-hmm. like you're not going to do well. And like we need to sort people better, and everything will get better. But the idea that you know, school districts are going to try and shut down or regulate or extract a tax out of TikTok and mm-hmm. Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, you've got to be kidding me! Like that is such an evasion of basic responsibility. And if I may, like this is where, you know, you get past the right-left thing, because conservatives and progressives both hate social media, right, for different reasons. But they're full of it. I mean, it's like it isn't those things that are failing our children when they spend, you know, 6 to 8 hours a day, 9 months out of the year in a public school. It's what's happening in the schools, I think.
Well, so as you say, social media is getting blamed for everything. And I just had dinner with Abigail Schrey, who I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, author. And I've talked to her a couple of times.
Her next book is about the, I'm not sure this is her term, but what it seemed to me, the sort of therapy industrial complex mm-hmm. and how American children are being ushered through therapy and everything, prescribed medicines and told they have various conditions. There's many other issues affecting Americans. And I wonder what you think those other ones are, which ones we should be really more concerned with.
I think that fundamentally what we are doing is we are in a we're in a fight between different what are called declension narratives. That the dominant discourse in America, and I suspect this is somewhat true in England or in the UK, and it is in most of Europe as well, which is that we live in a period after the golden age. And, you know, depending on who you are, you'll pick this was the golden age or that was the golden age. But we talk about everything as a crisis that needs to be addressed immediately, and I alone have the one solution. You know, and this is RFK Jr., has a hard-on about vaccines, you know, and it's COVID vaccines now. Before that, it was MMR, but that's why everything is screwed up, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Abigail Schreier will have a different thing, and it's about gender ideology, mm-hmm. and, you know, and that's destroying every, you know, other people will say it's You know, it's Instagram, and it is forcing, you know, it's making people want things that they will never be able to afford, you know, whatever it is. Like, there's all sorts of things. You know, people will say it's late capitalism, you know, and this is, you know, we're just grinding to the end of
any liberalism.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and the first and foremost thing that we should be doing is kind of reevaluating these declension narratives. Because, in fact, when you look in America, if you look at things like after taxes and transfer payments, the number of children who are living in poverty is at an all-time low. The number of single women with children or households with children at all-time lows. You know, the amount of medical...
Is that in America?
In America. Uh-huh. But then again, around the world, things are going fantastically well. You know, 25 years ago, when the UN started talking about, we want to, you know, help knock down the absolute poverty rate around the world, we hit those milestones and blew through them much quicker than anybody thought. You know, fewer people die of weather-related disasters around the world at any point in history. In absolute terms, even though we have many more people in the globe, much less, you know, in percentages and things like that, there are so many things that are going well. Women are doing fantastically well in contemporary America by most material yardsticks, things like graduating from college, medical school, law school. And yet, what do we, you know, what do we hear about? It's like that everything is darkness.
Well, forgive me for then not following you in this positive conversation, because I don't want to keep concentrating
on the fault lines and the
I was just going to say that libertarians are usually apocalyptic. They're like, you know, if you raise this tax, 0.25% civilization is fragile and it'll disappear. But it's like we're actually in the middle of a hell of a run, including after COVID. You know, within a couple months, when COVID started, and then people were talking about, okay, we got to get vaccines for this stuff, they were saying it's going to take 3 to 5 years to get vaccines, you know, prepped and ready and out into the world. And it took 8 months. And it could have been shorter if we changed the way that we actually go through the approval process of drugs. And I realize, you know, there are issues about the way that we dealt with COVID. The public health authorities lied about stuff consistently. We should have been more attuned to how COVID affected different people of different ages. And we punished, you know, young children, and we punished young adults, particularly men, you know, I'm against vaccine mandates under almost all circumstances and under the COVID, you know, regime. But, you know, we had this worldwide pandemic, which we essentially figured out how to end it in a record period of time, far more better than the most optimistic forecast. And we are still like, oh, you know what, this world is horrible. It's terrible. It's like, no, we're like doing quite well as a planet and as a society and as a civilization.
Well, having just read RFK's book on Tony Fauci, I could go into my criticisms of the vaccine, but
and Fauci does, you know, for reasons that sometimes parallel but are distinct from what Kennedy does. Now, Fauci has so much to answer for. We just did at Reason a hour and a half long conversation with Matt Ridley, the great science writer who also co-authored.
This is why he's such an optimist, because you've been speaking to Matt Ridley.
Yeah, he's a rational optimist and also very tall. Like, you know, and he's British. It's like everything's coming up roses with Matt Ridley. But, you know, it was a critique of the way the public health authorities acted during COVID, and also the way they worked with the government and Twitter and Facebook and other social medias to squelch the lab leak theory for reasons that are deeply, deeply disturbing. Mm-hmm. And absolutely, everybody should be livid at this. But so there's a lot of reasons to be, angry and truly critical of Anthony Fauci. Mm-hmm. There's also that large point that we are done with this pandemic. And the next one is likely not to be as bad because we know we made certain advances with mRNA vaccines. And again, we could get into a conversation about that. But, you know, this is like we did pretty well.
I wanted to ask you about a poll that you published at Reason. I think it was a Newsweek one.
Yes.
About the rise in popularity of making misgendering a crime. 44% of millennials
want to make misgendering a crime.
Right.
In America, 38% of 35 to 44-year-olds said it should be a crime. And this seems to match up with what I've witnessed in the creative industries, mm-hmm. GLAAD, Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, posted an open letter signed by hundreds of artists and celebrities alike, including people like Judd Apatow, Amy Schumer, Jamil, and many others, looking for the censorship of misgendering, dead naming people, censorship of misinformation about healthcare for trans kids in line with COVID censorship. It seems that censorship is popular. And that's particularly startling in this country with the First Amendment. I wondered why you think that this is the case that the younger generations have taken this turn, or why they don't necessarily value free speech, or why, let's say, even I'm not sure it's hate speech necessarily to misgender someone. It might be an accident.
But it seems like it's being roped into the idea that it is hate speech and hate speech should be actionable and things like that. I mean, this, where, again, to go back to the starting point, I think, of this conversation, there's definitely a spasm of, censorship or censoriousness, censorialness, that is alive and kind of growing, right? Which is deeply, deeply disturbing. I think, so I'm turning 60 in a couple of weeks. I'm at the end of the baby boom. And I grew up in a moment, like I grew up in the 70s and 80s, really, and that I took for granted that free speech, even objectionable speech, was, that was the ante of living in a free society and a good society, is that you would put up with bad speech and you would counter it with better speech, right? Mm-hmm. This is like the ACLU used to talk about this all the time. And the ACLU is now on the side of censoring things, right? Or, I don't know that they want to criminalize misgendering people, but they've abdicated their open speech, kind of positions.
As of the SPLC.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is deeply, deeply disturbing. And I think one of the, to ask why are millennials or, younger people who were raised by baby boomers who supposedly care about free speech? I mean, this is an interesting kind of conundrum. And I think that a lot of boomers have given up on free speech because they feel like, oh, things are too important now. And they taught their children. I have two kids. One is a millennial and one is Gen X. I didn't teach them this, but they got from a lot of different places that, speech is the equivalent of action, or, and that words wound, like bullets or knife blades or something like that. And this is what happens when you teach that there's an equation between speech and action. Then you have to police speech because it's the same thing as like pushing someone in the face.
Who's been teaching there's an equation between speech and action?
Yeah, I think that is coursing through K-12 education. I think through a lot of, media and creative work and things like that. I think, and I wrote about this in 98 or 99, you mentioned childproofing the world. I wrote a cover story for Reason called Childproofing the World. And it was in the late 90s, children by every possible measure were doing better than ever. And there was a concerted effort, mostly coming from liberal and progressive forces, like Hillary Clinton was a leader in this, to childproof the world because they were saying that kids were at higher and higher risk for all sorts of problems, including encountering violent video games or violent music. This was in a era when the Parents Music Resource Center was saying, listening to Darling Nikki by Prince or She Bop by Cyndi Lauper, insanely, would somehow ruin children forever. Mm-hmm. That worldview has, just dominated and dominated. I chalked it up to a number of things, including the fact that we were having fewer children, so each child took on relative more weight. We were spending more raising kids as a society. Literally, we were putting fewer eggs in a basket and projecting all of our hopes and our anxieties on them, and we wanted to protect them. It's like the story of the Buddha. The Buddha's parents, the Buddha's father wants to keep him in a walled garden where he never sees illness or poverty or death or old age. We've been doing that as a society for the past 30 years at least.
We've become more precious
about our children. And it's all proceeds from this absolutely misbegotten premise that children are not resilient, and that society is not resilient. And I think it's now taken on a logic of its own. I think compounding that, the kids who were raised under that, who are the ones who are, 25 to 34 or 25 to 44, are moving into power now. There's a generational dynamic to this. The baby boom, which was between 46 and 64, was such a massive generation. And it kicked out, as it was moving into, its 30s and 40s, it dethroned the greatest generation and the silent generation, the people, who fought World War II and, were before, who came of age before the 60s. And you use generational shifts like this, you use whatever is around to get rid of the old guard.
Mm-hmm.
We are going through something similar like that. The millennial generation is a massive cohort, and especially when you combine it with Gen Z, baby boomers are sticking around longer. They're clogging up. They're at the top of the masthead. They're at the top of the, corporation. They're still dominating a lot of cultural production. I mean, that's starting to shift. But I think part of what you're seeing now from this, group, the, let's say millennials, people in their early 40s to late 20s, you're seeing not a coordinated effort, but a concerted effort to dislodge the baby boom generation. And one of the ways to do that, Me Too was part of that.
Mm.
Speech police is part of that, because who is most stricken? Now, it's like COVID was the boomer remover, right? Like it mostly killed old people. So did these efforts. I think a lot of them are aimed at pushing out older people. So you have people who are raised to believe words are violence and that, you need to police everything because otherwise you're going to hurt people and cause trauma, which has been expanded in its definition to include basically everyday life. You have that, and then you have the need, to get rid of the people who are clogging up the works.
If the birth rate decline is continuing, what is the way out of this preciousness? Or maybe a broader question is, how do we show the value of free speech? How does this turn around?
Yeah, those are great questions. One, embedded in the idea that declining birth rates or fertility rates is a problem is a sense that, if there are fewer people on the planet, economic and kind of social progress stops. And there's a lot of theorists who believe that, both libertarians, conservatives, liberals, and progressives mostly agree that on some level, like if you have a shrinking population, it's hard to maintain economic and material progress.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, given that, the early end of the baby boom in the late 60s and early 70s was fixated on overpopulation. There were too many people on the planet, destroying Mother Earth. We needed to really depopulate. And now, of course, now that we have that, it's not here yet, but it's in the, it's on the horizon. Now people are freaking out.
Yeah.
Oh, we're not going to have enough people. I think there's a couple things. One is that like fertility declines, again, are one of these things where a year ago or so, there were tons of news reports because there was a Census Bureau that women were having fewer babies, like millennial women were having fewer babies than ever. Oh, what a freak out. But it's like, actually what that reflects is the fact that women have more opportunities and options and that both men and women want smaller families because they, they're doing more, we're living longer, we're doing more things. It's actually the decline in fertility is the result, I would argue, of modernity winning, of giving people more options and more control over their biology. I don't see that in and of itself as a problem that needs to be corrected, because it's also a global phenomenon. Everywhere, people are having fewer kids. And the reason for that is because they have more individual control over their reproduction.
Are you sure that there's an actual desire for fewer kids? Or let's say in the West, could it not be that there's, for example, in Britain, we have a housing crisis, very expensive, because this is the same thing across Europe. it's that actually families can't afford, or it's a big financial, bigger than ever financial hit.
There's a demographer or a social scientist at the American Enterprise Institute named Scott Winship who has looked at this, and he looked at the number, he looked at data that asked, you know, boomer women in the late, or not boomer women, but women in the late 50s and early 60s, how many kids did you want to have? And then how many kids did they have, to see like how close did they get to their goal, you know, their dream of when they were in their, you know, 20s. And then he did the same thing with early millennials. And millennials wanted fewer kids, but they're closer to their aspirational goal than boomer women were.
Mm.
I think what has happened, and this is something, you know, I've mentioned I grew up, I'm a boomer, and I went to Catholic school. When I was in grammar school and high school, like, there were always a couple of families in every grade that had, you know, 8 or 12 kids. I mean, it was a very cartoon Catholic thing, right? Those families don't exist anymore. And I don't think that's primarily because, college costs a lot or housing has gone up. It's also true, like, housing, when you get outside of a few market areas, is not as, you know, housing has gone up a lot in New York. It hasn't, you know, if you're in a small town in Ohio or something, it's not, you know, it's still affordable. But I think women, this is something that Jonathan Last, who is a conservative writer, who is at the Weekly Standard and is now at the Dispatch, I believe, wrote a book about it called What to Expect When Nobody's Expecting. And he concluded, you know, across the globe, everybody agrees that the more years of education women have, the fewer children they have. So I think it's right to say that, and he actually says, you know, that to change that is, you would have to repeal modernity, where women have more control and autonomy over their bodies, where they have more options, where they have more rights and equal status in society.
Mm-hmm.
I think, yeah. So I don't think that the push for fewer children is either because things are more expensive or because, you know, the other thing that you hear a lot, particularly on the left, is I don't want to bring a child into a world that is about to burn to death, or say, the planet is about to become a cinder. I think it reflects a lot of changes that are global and that are not going to change anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
A human civilization is a movement towards fewer kids per family.
And which,
which is a move, by the way, towards the end of the human race.
Maybe, maybe not. It's, you know, because we're also much more efficient and productive. I think it will represent, or it will produce, certain kinds of challenges. You see this, Japan is the one developed economy that has fewer people now than it had in 2000. It is an intensely closed society. It is, when it comes to reproduction and many other things, including female status, it's a very dysfunctional society, and they are going to have to change if they want to maintain a standard of living.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just regarding gender, but, you know, they have, since really the early 1990s, they have gone into an economic slide, a kind of sideways movement that they won't be able to maintain forever, but because they won't allow markets to function and flush out poorly performing companies, because they are a mix of hyper, you know, kind of creative destruction in markets and traditional structures. And that's not going to work forever. I think America is becoming a little bit ossified like that. I think parts of Europe have. And this, again, is like, we need to leave the 20th century behind. And instead of starting to say, you know what, we need to get back to that moment after World War II, where for the first time in recorded history, birth rates started going up for a little bit, you know, the baby boom in the U.S. anyway. And we have to be, this is the reality. How do we maximize happiness? How do we create individual rights? How do we create meaning in the world,
mm-hmm.
given where we are now, not where we were in 1970 or 1950?
Mm-hmm.
So your other question was, how do we reverse this question about free speech? And I think, for me, free speech is important because individual expression is, you know, the thing that I value the most, probably. And I don't mean that just in speech. I mean that, like, you know, you should be able to live your life the way that you want to. I should be able to do that. I should be able to run my business the way that I want to, you know, et cetera. I think that's a better world. It's a more interesting world, a more productive world, a more prosperous world, ultimately a more fair world.
And this is the libertarian.
Yeah, very much so, I think. And, you know, that's a really good question. Like, how do we start to build a culture of free speech and of free expression and of not anarchy, not everyone for themselves, but a kind of laissez-faire that then also has a communal aspect to it and builds, you know, has a respect for the need of a social safety net and to make sure that everybody is enfranchised in a society.
What does a social safety net mean for a libertarian like
yourself? For me, yeah, I know, you know, and I speak for myself here. A lot of libertarians call themselves or, you know, or actually they'll say they're anarcho-capitalists. So they don't believe that there should be any government or that there needs to be any government, that things will work out otherwise. I'm not there. I'm more of a classical liberal coming out of 18th and 19th century kind of revolutions in both in industry, but also mostly in political philosophy, where I believe in a limited government. And I think, you know, one of the ways that we do that, we have a government in America that since 2000, you know, has quintupled or quadrupled, or we've gone from tripled. We went from annual budgets in the federal government of about $2 trillion to over $6 trillion, and it looks like we're not coming back. The government is doing too many things. It's spending too much, and it does very few of them well. Mm-hmm. We need a government that is smaller but more effective in the things that it provides. And I think, you know, there's like national defense. We could easily cut the defense budget in half, and America wouldn't be any less safe. I don't think our interests around the world would be less safe. We just spent 20 years, you know, prosecuting two disastrous wars, you know, and in Afghanistan. It's darkly laughable that, you know, we went in there, deposed the Taliban, built a bunch of shit, left things behind, and then to the Taliban, it's like, here you go, take over, right? You know, it's like, that wasn't good. I don't think we did. You know, the Middle East is doing better now that we have left. You know, and this is partly Donald Trump and the Abraham Accords set things up in motion where the, you know, the Middle East, the people in the Middle East are starting to do what they need to be, you know, what they need to in order to have a better place. But we could reduce the size of defense spending. We could reduce the amount of social welfare spending so that, you know, most transfer payments, you know, where tax dollars go to a favored group, those aren't going to poor people. They're not going to people who need food, clothing, and shelter. They're going to middle-class people, you know, to subsidize student loans, to subsidize healthcare, to subsidize mortgage interest payments. Like, we need to radically reduce the size, scope, and spending of government and have it be effective and efficient on the people it's helping. And that is the beginning. That would be a reboot that I think would help us become a livelier, more responsive society.
You know, you just progressives, conservatives, Democrats, and Republicans alike are all up in arms by the state of the world. You've just described how big the government expenditure is.
Yeah.
And yet you call yourself the optimistic libertarian.
Yeah, yeah.
Where's your optimism derived from?
Yeah, you know, it's because this, and, you know, the last few years have certainly been taxing to this optimism and possibly to the, you know, the veracity of this statement. I've always believed that we generally, you know, technology is the kind of handmaiden or the engine of a lot of freedom. You know, once you have, you know, better technology, people can live more on their own, or, you know, we have more developed markets. So like, I don't have to churn my own butter and make my own clothes, et cetera. Huh. And a lot of that is, you know, it's both policy and political theory, but it's also just technology. And I think that what we have seen over the past couple of hundred years, at least, is that the technology that allows us to live more freely outpaces the growth of the government to kind of hem it all in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of my optimism. I mean, government is growing, you know, but there is a surplus of kind of autonomy that comes from these things, as well as the breakdown in social mores and things like that. And again, I realize for conservatives and traditionalists, and they can be right, or for, let's say, traditionalists, and they can be right-wing or left-wing, the breakdown of things like the church, whatever church you believe in, but in religiosity, the breakdown in the belief that there are there's a Mandarin class that knows best, whether we're talking about what is the best art, what is the best culture and literature, or what is the best way to live. Those are breaking down, and that frees up individualism. I'm more able to live my life the way that I want to than my parents were or my grandparents were. I think my children will have even more ability to do that despite the growth of government. But that doesn't mean we should allow government to just keep growing and kind of be a barnacle on the whole of, the great ship freedom or something like that. I think things would be much better. And most importantly, I'm like upper class, I think, on a strict income level and things like that. I can take care of myself. If we reduce the size, scope, and spending of government and target it on people who needed it, I think we would be enabling and empowering those people to live fuller, richer lives.
You don't sound like a libertarian to me. You sound like a liberal.
Yeah, in English.
In an English sense. Yeah. But maybe that's my, this, yeah, maybe that's
I don't take that as an insult or anything. It's interesting because the libertarian movement, which really, doesn't start in its current form until at least after World War II and maybe even like in the late 60s and early 70s, that has been drifting more and more towards anarchism, which I think is different. So like, I'm not a foundationalist where everything, we've got to go back to, year zero and rebuild the world anew according to the right principles. Mm-hmm. I'm an incrementalist, or sometimes I call myself a directional libertarian, mm-hmm. where it's like, if we are moving in the direction of more individual freedom and autonomy, let's do that, and let's get there a little bit faster.
There's some of the things you've described, for example, reducing expenditure on American military, the military industrial complex, sort of makes. I would imagine that a character like RFK,
would be your guy.
The same thing. He's saying that most vocally of all the candidates
of the major candidates. Vivek Ramaswamy might be saying something similar. It gets confusing. The thing is, when I talk to RFK Jr., it's also, on other levels, like I asked him, it's not clear that he would cut overall government spending. So he believes, that the military industrial complex is real. He believes the deep state, particularly the CIA, killed both his father, improbably, to be honest, and his uncle, JFK, more probable, but I also think wrong. He is not libertarian in the sense that he doesn't envision a world in which the government is doing fewer things and less things. But on certain issues, we kind of line up in terms of the immediate, policy prescription.
Do you think, and maybe tying back to earlier in the conversation about social media, do you think that there's a time for some of the antitrust that we saw, let's say, with the Sherman Act in 1890, Big Pharma, we've talked about big tech. Is it time to break up these big monopolies? Is that part of the problem?
Yeah, I don't think so. And this might be the dogmatic libertarian in me. I'm very taken by the analysis of a lot of antitrust law that both some socialist historians as well as libertarian kind of public choice economists are called, where they reverse the script and say, the big story that gets told by progressives in America is that, in the coming into the 20th century, the robber barons, controlled everything. And then a band of plucky, invigorated liberal, or not liberal, but progressive reformers came in and said, we're not going to let the railroad run roughshod over individual people, et cetera. And there was a socialist historian called Gabriel Kolko who showed that actually, when it came to the railroad regulation, the railroads were the ones calling for it and abetting it all along because their profits had started flattening or declining. And they went to the government, at the state and federal level, and they were like, it's time to regulate us. And they did that in a way where it fixed the market for, until the Carter administration, essentially. where it created a bunch of federal commissions. And
but that's agencies. Something different, though. That's crony capitalism.
No, but this is, when you talk about social media in 2018, Congress, you know, finally got around to saying, oh, you know what, social media is bad. Facebook, Twitter, Amazon, you know, all of you people come here and talk to us because you have monopoly power. And what happened? Mark Zuckerberg and Tim Cook of Apple and other people were like, hey, you know, you're right. The tech sector should be regulated. And you know what? We're the ones who know the business. Mark Zuckerberg actually literally said this to Congress. I will help you write the regulations so that Facebook is fair. It means, you know, like there's not going to be any more Facebooks because once you regulate a market, you fix it.
Mm-hmm.
But like, are you okay with that? And the dolts in Congress, and I mean, this is important to recognize, they were, you know, 800-year-old mummies holding up cell phones saying, can you help me use this app better? So I don't think antitrust in almost no real case when you look at it, is it helping the consumer? It is always somehow serving special interests, most typically corporate interests, to fix the market in the name of helping the public. So, and I think that's true of the push to, you know, break up social media companies. What have we seen in the past year and a half? Facebook changed its name to Meta. Mm. It went into the metaverse. It's losing money, or, you know, it's losing power and market share. It doesn't matter in the way that it did even 2 years ago. And it's going to continue to decline because Threads, good bid, probably not going to unseat anything. Twitter, there are massive alternatives to Twitter. And, you know, there are robust markets in these things.
So this isn't really an argument against monopoly as much as against what actually happens when regulation comes in. And I thought that libertarians wouldn't have a problem with monopoly, and it would be a more classical liberal position to be against monopoly, like a free market.
Or do you think that it actually is a free market? It depends when you look at the actual market. So, you know, this is also one of the major, you know, cases of this was Standard Oil, run by John D. Rockefeller. And at its moment of peak market penetration, when it had more, the greatest market share, it was charging the least amount for home heating oil, its main product,
mm-hmm.
and lighting fuel and stuff like that, because markets that are monopolies that are in markets, the way they maintain their position is generally by giving people more stuff at lower prices. And I think, you know, this was true of AOL in the late 90s and early 2000s when people were saying it's a monopoly because it dominated the ISP market. And it was giving people more free stuff than ever. And then it imploded.
This is something Jonathan Tepper argues against in a book called The Myth of Capitalism, is that actually there is evidence that those big monopolies are fixing prices and monopsonies fixing prices, which is hurting the consumer just as much. So it isn't clear to me that it's so obvious that monopoly is a good thing.
Yeah, and I'm not saying monopoly is a good thing. Functioning markets are a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So those are slightly different. But even something like Amazon, you know, Jet came along and is, you know, there are certain industries, or Etsy. I mean, like, if you define, you know, whenever you get into antitrust action, you have to define the relevant market. And then it's like, what is the market that Amazon is monopolizing?
Mm-hmm.
And then do people have more, or, you know, do they have more or fewer options to get the things that they're getting through Amazon?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, we're doing pretty well as a consumer society. And I know a lot of people who sell things on Amazon and they hate working with Amazon. Amazon is like Walmart, you know, a generation earlier, where it's like it's very punishing to be a producer, you know, a vendor for these companies, because they really squeeze you for every penny in order to offer generally lower prices to a wider variety of people. But again, my general analysis of monopoly and things like that is like, is the consumer better or worse off? We can argue in certain ways, you know, would it be better if Facebook was forced to carry all speech equally and couldn't prioritize things or not? I don't know, you know, but we're never going to live in that world, because the minute you say that, then, well, what about hate speech? And then who gets to define hate speech, et cetera? And like, then we get mired in all of this, you know, this web of regulation and committee and bureaucracy over what is available, what is allowable, and all of that. Mm-hmm. I think it's generally better to let markets kind of sort that out.
Nick, on that note, I'm going to say thank you very much for speaking with me. Fascinating. And maybe you can tell listeners and watchers where they can find you.
Yeah. Reason.com is the website for Reason. Everything shows up there eventually. And we have a video platform. We have a bunch of podcasts and articles, plus the magazine goes up there. So Reason.com is great. And I'm probably most visible, sadly, at Twitter or whatever we're calling it now. My handle is at Nick Gillespie, all lowercase, all one word. Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure and an honor.